Welcome to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Each episode will explore DIY bio, citizen science, and medical device security with guests from the healthcare, cybersecurity research, and biohacking communities. Hosted by Nina Alley and Bo Woods.
Hello, Bo. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I bet you're good after that dance move. That was good.
Dance moves that I'm putting on. Yeah. There's a clinic in here on how not to dance.
It's the club scene.
It's the club scene.
Throwback to your club days. Super magical.
Club days. Yeah. So.
We have someone amazing on today.
We do.
Yeah.
We were just talking about this before we hit record. Tramell Hudson is our guest today. Tramell, as his bio says, likes to take things apart, and that's the only part of his bio that we know. So he is an international man of mystery. Tramell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. So one of my real passions is understanding how electronics work and figuring out how to make them better suited for my needs as well as for the needs of the other people who have those devices. About 10 years ago, I started a project called the Magic Lantern firmware for the Canon cameras. And this literally came out of the fact that there was one feature that I wanted out of these cameras that they didn't have. And I was so frustrated that I reverse engineered Canon's firmware, figured out how to load my own software onto it, and ended up creating a whole community that now has a few hundred thousand users around the world and even in outer space who are using custom firmware in their cameras. And the ability to customize things, I think, is a really crucial thing for people who have needs that aren't necessarily met by the device manufacturers. So things like being able to write your own programs that run inside of these things is a really powerful way to both to use older hardware as well as to use lower cost hardware that can open up a lot of new opportunities.
That's super cool. I think I actually used the Magic Lantern firmware that you put out because, like you, there were a few features that I knew that the Canon could do, but that just weren't enabled in software. So thank you for that earlier project too. That's pretty, pretty amazing.
And it's really something that is possible on a whole range of devices that, software is eating the world and little ARM CPUs are showing up in absolutely everything these days. So being able to write software that runs on those devices can really radically change how we interact with the world and how we interact with the devices that we own. And it's really an interesting thing to take apart a lot of devices, find a familiar CPU or a familiar SoC inside, and then be able to say, oh, I know how that worked in this other device, so I can start to write new functions and extend the functionality. Another project I'm working on these days is a replacement firmware for IKEA light bulbs. And you might say, how can light bulbs have firmware? But pretty much everything, all of the smart lighting these days has a small ARM SoC inside, usually with the Zigbee radio. And again, there's some minor frustrations I have with features that Zigbee doesn't implement the way that I want it to. And the easiest way to do it is to disassemble the firmware and figure out how to add in those functions for my own use.
And this is so that you can get that club lighting feel when you're at home, right?
To be honest, the number one feature that I wanted out of the IKEA lights is a dimmer setting. That they are, even at the lowest brightness, they're still much, much too bright for a nightlight. That's because they're doing their PWM with a 5% duty cycle at the lowest brightness. So by reaching into the firmware and tweaking that that lookup table, I'm able to bring it down all the way to a fraction of a percent. So it doesn't wake you up in the middle of the night if you have to turn it on. And then along the way, I also decided to port MicroPython to it. So now the light bulbs in the house are running Python.
That's amazing. I think there's going to be some future contest of what can you put Python on around your home. I think that's probably a contender for one of the coolest things to put Python on as of right now. But hey, somebody's going to out innovate that soon, and you'll have Python on your fridge, Python on your light switch, Python everywhere.
Usually folks think of Doom as the test of Turing completeness, that if a system can run Doom, then it's a real computer.
Yeah. So that begs the question, can your light bulb run Doom?
It doesn't have quite the resolution to display it. And
one
it's
pixel.
It's a little short on memory. The EFR32 in there has 32 kilobytes of RAM. So a little bit limited for serious games, but plenty for a MicroPython environment and interacting with other devices on the Zigbee network.
Yeah. Maybe Wolfenstein 3D. I remember playing that on a 286, I think, way back in the day. It probably still had more than 32K of RAM, though.
More than 32K. But CPU-wise, they're probably pretty similar in speeds. These little microcontrollers are 32-bit CPUs running at 10s or hundreds of megahertz compared to 16-bit 286 running at, you know, tens of megahertz.
Yeah. Yeah, is that like an A0 chip?
Yeah, the M0 is...
M0.
In one of my other talks, looking at hardware supply chain implants, I ran across the bit of trivia that an M0 ARM CPU takes up less space than two transistors in a 6502 from a few years ago.
Wow.
That they're literally, you know, 0.1 millimeter square CPUs. So, you know, talk about, you know, smart dust or the ability to put CPUs in literally anything.
I feel like your house is the Jetsons house.
It's mostly full of broken things that I've taken apart. Because notice that my bio doesn't say I necessarily put them back together.
Just waiting for Rosie to come up in the back and give you like a thing of tea.
Cool. So given the background and your history with taking things apart, reverse engineering firmware, and then, in those cases, putting it back together in a modified form. Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to look at ventilators, what that project looks like, and then where did it come from? How did you do it? And where is it going?
So, and I need to, of course, preface pretty much all of my comments on this podcast with that I am not a respiratory physician. I have no medical experience. I'm literally just the firmware person on this project. Physicians and on the East Coast of the U.S. got in touch with me because they were concerned about the ventilator shortage, and they were looking at work that had been done at Mount Sinai to use BiPAP machines off-label as emergency ventilators, that Mount Sinai has received FDA approval for protocols that they've developed for non-invasive ventilation with BiPAPs and some viral filters and other equipment. The folks who contacted me looked at that protocol and realized that the CPAP machines, which were a fraction of the price of the BiPAPs that Mount Sinai was using, probably had all of the necessary sensors, and that it was just a simple matter of software to add the functionality into the firmware for those inexpensive CPAP machines to be able to adapt them and use them under similar protocols. So they drop-shipped a very inexpensive CPAP machine to me, and I spent 2 weeks of pulling it apart and disassembling the firmware to understand how it works, and then worked with them to test out some customized firmware in a research lab setting, so they could validate the sensor data and the flow parameters and various characteristics that they felt were important to try to pursue emergency use authorization for this sort of these modifications. While I was in there, I realized that there's a lot of people who use CPAP machines who are also interested in being able to add additional features to them. So I went ahead and published my results on the airbrake.dev website, showing how anybody who has one of these inexpensive CPAP machines can modify the firmware to add new functionality to it or to adapt it for their specific sleep therapy needs. You know, as again, I'm not part of that community. I don't use one of these machines for any sort of sleep therapy, but there's a very active community of folks who are interested in using them and extending the capabilities. And the machines are really quite capable. They have very nice motors with three-phase brushless drives. They have lots of sensors that allow them to do closed-loop control, as well as recording very interesting data. And this is data that the users of the machines want to be able to act on, that the default firmware logs it and sends it off to the insurance companies and to the physicians. But folks who are interested in their own sleep therapies want to gain access and want to gain real-time access to that data. And that's another thing that the AirBrake firmware allows them to do.
That's really cool. So by getting into this firmware, were you adding new functionality to it? Were you unlocking existing functionality? Some of both?
A little bit of both. The initial plan was to write entirely new functionality. And the proof of concept that ended up being validated in the clinical setting, excuse me, in the research setting, was new functionality that we wrote what's called a pressure control ventilator software, that where the device is effectively breathing for the user on a time schedule, where the physician can set a respiratory rate and pressure, and then the device will try to maintain that for the user. While I was in there, I noticed that the manufacturer had also included all of the firmware for their whole range of devices and just had configuration bits to select which items were displayed in the menus. So, you know, and they sell these devices from $300 up to $5,000. And by flipping some bits in the firmware, you could turn that $300 device into effectively the $5,000 device.
Wow, that's really cool. When you enable those new menus and those new capabilities, do you know if that part went through any kind of research or clinical testing to demonstrate that it actually does what the software says it can do?
To the best of my knowledge, it is functioning you know, in those more advanced modes. The $300 device is missing a few hardware components compared to the higher end ones. But at the $600 level, it has, as far as I could tell, all of the same sensors and feedback mechanisms. So depending on which capabilities the user needs, you know, that's a very viable entry level machine.
That's really cool. What has the manufacturer said, or have they talked to you at all?
The manufacturer has not spoken to me at all. Initially, they said that the CPAP machines were not capable of doing this, and that they would, because they were only designed to deliver a constant pressure. That's the C in CPAP. After publication, they revised their statement to say that while technically they are capable of doing this, they had not received any requests from physicians to modify devices. Mm. So it's understandable that for market segmentation purposes, that they would build and certify one model of the hardware and one build of the software, and then sell them at different price points for the different capabilities. It's a little frustrating when, as an end user, as an end device owner, when you buy something and capabilities are locked behind software. Tesla does this with their batteries, for instance, that it doesn't matter which capacity battery set you buy, that you always get the high capacity one, and you get software limited range if you haven't paid for the extra ones. Or the autopilot function in Tesla is also a software only add-on. There's something recently where Tesla took that functionality away from someone who bought a used Tesla because they had not paid for the autopilot function in the used price.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that. And, you know, this just underscores something which I think, we haven't yet made apparent, but it's probably not something that it's not a characteristics of a single manufacturer. Probably a lot of medical devices on the market could have the same thing, where the capabilities are locked in software, but the physical components are capable of doing much, much more than what they currently do. If you look around and look at some of the insulin pumps that are on the market today, insulin pumps and continuous glucose monitors, some of those are capable of doing much more than they actually do. And so there's a whole homebrew community that is dedicated to the idea that they want to unlock their devices so that they can have better control over their disease, better monitoring, better capabilities to treat, and to understand their own physiology. And I think that that's something that's very forward-looking of a lot of those people. I wonder if you've run across any of those initiatives, any of those movements, if you've been involved in those at all.
I have not been involved in any of those. I've enjoyed reading on Hackaday and some of the other sites about, folks building closed loop insulin pumps to make artificial pancreases. And this sort of market segmentation is very common. As you point out, that the FLIR camera, for instance, sold a low-res camera that had the high-res sensor, and folks realized that they could patch the firmware to take advantage of it. Or the Rigel oscilloscopes come in different bandwidth ratings. And again, you can unlock the higher bandwidth just by installing a different firmware. I haven't personally worked with them, but I have heard that the Philips CPAP and BiPAP machines are also simply software limited. And by swapping the firmwares, you can gain access to the BiPAP functionality.
So, given the extraordinary times that we're in, and given that ventilators are in such high demand, or devices that can help solve some of the respiratory issues, what has the reaction from the FDA been? Have you spoken with them?
So the FDA is very interested in how some of these devices could be used in these sort of off-label uses. As I mentioned, the Mount Sinai has received a emergency use authorization for their BiPAP protocols to use them as ventilators. And I expect that the FDA would be interested in a protocol using modified CPAP machines as well. Although, to the best of my knowledge, no medical groups have yet presented the FDA with the paperwork to do so.
So let me ask you this. Aside from the United States, obviously a lot of other countries are looking for creative solutions where they can reduce costs and increase capacity of delivering care. Have you heard from any other places other than the United States?
So I have heard that there's a lot of interest in parts of the developing world and some of the less resource-rich countries. That in the US and the EU, it seems that the peak ventilator demand has probably been passed, at least for this for the first wave. And however, there's a lot of countries that are potentially still on the upward slope and would have a need to be able to ramp up a ventilator capacity very rapidly. And I've heard from a few FDA equivalents that they are interested in pursuing some of these options for how could they quickly acquire and reflash devices. Most of them are looking to the FDA for the US FDA for a stamp of approval, you know, that for some sort of protocols and uses. And we tried to be really clear on the airbreak.dev website that these off-label uses are not FDA approved. And the best way would be for the manufacturer to sign off on these sorts of uses rather than requiring the clinical groups to come up with protocols on their own.
What's something that really surprised you when you started digging into these devices or when you've some of the other things that are less technical, more procedural or more regulatory? What have you learned from going through this process?
So I've learned a lot about sleep apnea treatments just by virtue of, you know, that's where a lot of the community around these machines is. And I'm really surprised at the way a lot of these machines are purchased and prescribed. That they're not like cell phones that you or laptops that you just go to a big box store or order from an online retailer. That they are prescribed and paid for by insurance companies, and the devices have cellular modems that upload usage stats to the insurance companies. And if a patient is not using the device, the insurance company stops paying for it. And that's just such a weird model of sale compared to pretty much every other electronic device that you might have in your home.
I think that also has to do, I think that also has to do with patient compliance, ensuring that the patient is doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and then they pay. So I think that's a growing part of the healthcare industry. But just running back into what you said and what we were talking about. So there's this new realm of devices that you can use them in their current capabilities and then unlock their next level achievement. Being that folks in healthcare have these consistently and constant changing needs for features, where do you think this sort of research and the findings are going to go?
Yeah. There's also something I was trying to find just recently that some hospital that was repairing their devices, and the manufacturers were going after them for repairing their own hardware.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the sad truths of healthcare. When you're using something and you find out it works better in a different way and you can start maneuvering it to do such a thing, I think healthcare needs that. A lot of how healthcare has come up with their devices or their methodologies has come from sort of like a Britney Spears moment. Oops, I did it again, but it worked. And let me see if I can refine it. Let me see if I can change it, you know, to make it better for the patient. And I think this is one of those moments where we don't have a normal anymore, and we have to create our normal now or a new normal. I think this is one of those moments where manufacturers, whether it be medical devices or pharma or whoever, have an opportunity to expand their breadth and depth of knowledge and contact a hacker like you and say, I love what you did. Help us, rather than wag the finger and poo-poo your idea, because this is helping a group of people that right now need it. And they said, oh, we didn't know it worked that way, but it does. And now that it does, what else can we do with it?
So Nina, I think you just signed yourself up for doing a recreation of Oops, I Did It Again, instead of in a school, in a hospital environment.
It's not a bad idea. As long as you two are my backup dancers.
Oh, of course.
I love the saying that the sound of scientific progress is not eureka, but huh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is. It's that experimentation phase of, I wonder why that happened. And I think there's a lot of hacking that's the same way, right? It's, the curiosity that drives a lot of hackers to pull things apart is the same thing that drives a lot of scientists to investigate something, or engineers to try something new, a new mix of chemical compounds or what have you, that leads to this innovation that I think is critical. And I think that work like the work that you've been doing is that expression of that innovation. And I would love to see companies and public policies that align to encouraging that type of innovation rather than necessarily just conflating innovation with profit.
I think that's a wonderful way to put it, that the sort of hacker mindset and the scientific mindset are very, very similar. It's the, that's funny. Why did that happen? What happens if I do it again? Yeah, it's it's very much a, there's a wonderful quote by Matthew Garrett that, he's not very good with computers. He's just really bad at giving up. And I really feel that sort of mindset, that sort of mentality is how a lot of progress happens. That, somebody says, it seems like this should work this way, or why doesn't that work the way I think it should? And then, through experimentation, through research, through pulling things apart, you can find out how these things work. And, I think the right to repair, is a huge part of that as well, where you need to know how things work to be able to know how to repair them. And unfortunately, I think the right to repair and market segmentation are very much at odds, that, the right to repair is also the right to improve. And once you can start to improve things, it's possible that you might run into artificial limitations that have been imposed in software. If it's in your vehicle's batteries, if it's in your sleep apnea treatment devices, even if it's in your commercial ventilator in a hospital, that there's been some reports of manufacturers going after hospitals that are repairing their own ventilators, but aren't authorized repair facilities from the manufacturer. So these sorts of things, I think, are going to change the way a lot of healthcare and a lot of devices in general are going to be viewed from both the end user as well as the patients.
Yeah. So my favorite aha moment is Fleming when he made penicillin. So the background story is he had the Petri dishes out and he left a window open while he was on vacation, came back and one of the Petri dishes was gross, except that it didn't have, in one spot, it didn't have anything. And gut reaction to most people is they toss that because it's like, oh, that's gross. But he took it and he was like, but why? Why is this one spot not doing anything? And created penicillin, which is saving hundreds of millions of lives, which essentially you, I feel like, are the new Fleming. You saw a process and were like, this can be better. What about this? And changed it. Well done, you.
I think you're over.
Hashtag so proud. Whatever. Don't burn this down, Shamel. But honestly, right? We all have those moments of, well, what if we could change this? And then you do it and you end up saving how many lives?
And after having taken apart so many random electronic devices, at this point, it's now that my expectation is there's going to be an ARM CPU in there. It's probably going to be hackable. The vendor probably hasn't locked it down, to prevent firmware replacement. And I think that it's wonderful that there is a community of like-minded people who are interested in understanding how their devices work and how they can either jailbreak them or modify them for their own needs. Maybe it's not penicillin, but maybe it's a better app for your cell phone or for your camera or your light bulb.
Yeah, I would love to see a lot more of that at the Biohacking Village. And I think that's a great optimistic, hopeful note to end the conversation on. So Tramiel, thank you very much for joining us today. We greatly appreciate your insights. Tune in to White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, whitehatslabcoats.org, for show notes and everything else. And join the conversation on Twitter at @DC_BHV. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Find us on iTunes, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Join the community conversation and expand your gray matter on Twitter at @DC_BHV. And get transcripts, links, and show notes at whitehatslabcoats.org.